We're going to spend a few minutes hearing from Steve Weber from the faculty of the School of Information at UC Berkeley. And we're going to hear about the Center for Long-Term Cybersecurity, who's our host today. Fair introduction?
Thank you.
And if I know Steve, anything else he wants to tell us?
I will. Thank you, commissioners, for spending the time with us today. I'm aware of what time it is, so I'm going to try to be brief here and make a few points. The notion of a transition memo, to me, naturally focuses people's minds on the 100-day window during which a new administration can make some really dramatic moves and profound decisions. What I'd like to do is to just highlight for you for a few minutes some of the thoughts that I think came out from today and have come out from our work about the 1,000-day window, which I think the transition memo ought to address as well. When we started this center, we called it long-term cybersecurity because we had this sort of single motivating notion that we needed to go beyond the immediate concerns of today's and even tomorrow's attack, out to a longer and broader horizon where the issues and challenges that you're going to face could look very different from the ones we obsess about today. And of course, as has been said over the course of the day, that kind of argument doesn't in any way represent a claim or a notion that we don't have to worry about the short term. Point simply is it's a both and proposition, not an either or. So what we've tried to do is to get some insight in a disciplined way into what we believe the cybersecurity landscape will look like and what cybersecurity professionals will need to deal with going out to that longer term trajectory. Our work sort of, we decided to focus roughly on the period between now and 2020. 2020 is not a long time from now, and it's not what one would usually think of as a long-term sort of projection. We thought it was the sweet spot where the implications of many of the technologies and the political dynamics that have come up throughout the day that we already see today are just becoming visible would start to play out in ways that could actually surprise us. Concrete example, I think, was just raised in the last discussion of this panel. When this long-term sort of corrosive lack of trust flips to a point where ambient insecurity has created a view among large numbers of users that we start from the position that we interact with the net from a position of distrust rather than from a position of trust, that's a very, very different world. For commerce, for relationships with government, for relationships between people and individuals. So how have we done this? Well, one of the things that we've done over the last year has been to try to construct a set of scenarios, actually five, that look at significant, plausible, challenging opportunities and threats in that five-year timeframe. I'm not going to go through that work, obviously, now. It's readable on our website. Like all scenarios, they're not predictions. What we've tried to do is create some models that take key driving forces and exaggerate them a little bit, add the simplicity back. What I'd like to say is that the purpose of doing that kind of work and the need for that kind of work as well, I believe, in the Commission's report, is not to try to predict what that landscape is going to look like, but to force people to ask the question, how would I know empirically if the world was moving in one direction rather than another? What indicators should I be looking for now to make those kind of big investments? Many of the issues that, or many of the policy proposals that came up today are things that would be hard to reverse, that would require significant investments, including changes of institutions, which will be very, very hard to unravel, as we know. The business models and government policies that would need to come with those kinds of changes are not things anyone's going to go along with lightly. A second and potentially more important sort of output of that kind of work is, what is true across the landscape of scenarios that we can possibly imagine? What is true regardless of how these factors play out? And we came to a number of interesting conclusions about that in our exercise. I would ask you to do the same. And I'm going to just mention one because I think it's very, very simple, but it also sits behind many of the challenges that came up today. And simply this, there is an ongoing and ever-increasing demand for features, performance, extensions of digital capabilities, and that is going to continue to expand to fill the space of what is technically possible and then go just beyond it. Because that's the world that we've gotten used to. And that single observation, to me at least, in light of the kind of vagaries of human behavior that go along with it, mean that the digital realm will continue to be vulnerable no matter what. And that's just a fact of life we're going to live with. There's no silver bullet out there. And more importantly, there isn't going to be one. I don't think that surprises anyone in principle. But when you combine that argument with the observation about how deeply integrated these technologies are into human life, then I think we land at an important insight which could shape that 1,000-day view. And it's this. Cybersecurity is now approaching the point where it is probably the most profound psychosocial economic impact issue of the next decade. And that's going to be a very big deal. Now, look, I mean, we all know the internet has had a massive impact on nearly every facet of human life, whether we're talking about psychology, sociability, economy. But frankly, cybersecurity issues have not, for most of the people outside of this room, had that kind of impact on their lives. The ugly truth is, for individuals, it's largely been a nuisance or an embarrassment, sometimes a little bit of a financial toll, a source of fear and worry, but not a fundamental risk that changes how they live. For firms, attacks, a vulnerability, a worry, but not one that rises to that sort of existential level for most firms. The kinds of things that keep CEOs up at night. Unexpected shifts in consumer behavior, economic crises. I would say the same is true for most, not all governments. Now, if that's about to change, and I think many of the things I've heard today lead me to believe that it is about to change, that has lots of consequences. And it requires us to think very, very differently about how we're going to structure the conversation going forward, to say nothing of what you guys are going to propose about that 100-day window. So look, I mean, I have to say I'm generally skeptical of analogies from the nuclear era. The nuclear deterrence doctrine and the cyber realm strike me as very, very different. But I think there is one analogy that is actually quite powerful and works exactly right. And it has to do with the way an earlier generation probably experienced the period of the 1950s with regard to the nuclear threat. So I'm going to think about what mutually assured destruction felt like, not in 1980, but in 1950. Recurrent global crises, and a sort of experience that, like, the day-to-day act of walking to work and walking by those fallout shelter signs that we used to see in New York City, that changed the way people thought about their lives. It changed the way they thought about the sanctity of life, about themselves, their families, their relationship with technology, their relationship with science, their faith in governments, their place on the planet. And I want you to imagine and help your readers imagine how it will feel as cybersecurity enters that kind of arena of impact. When corporations and governments are able to predict individual behavior and come to know ourselves better than we actually know ourselves. When memories and emotions are stored, searchable, shareable, and possibly changeable. These are the kinds of things, at least for me, go to the essence of what it means to be human, and ultimately rise to the level of a feeling that we call security. And those kinds of changes, to me, look like the source of unpredictable consequences that emerge at the intersection of human and digital machines. And that's what needs to be addressed, more so even than the contemporary debates, which are really just getting started about issues like jobs taken by robots or artificial intelligence escaping the control of human goals and objectives. I would be sorry to see the commission not take on some of those issues. So if that's right, then I think, at least from our perspective, the issues of cybersecurity start to take on the feeling of the way we've thought about climate change, like an existential risk question that demands a global commitment of political, economic, and technological resources, as well as change behaviors on the part of billions of people. And that sounds like a ridiculously tall order. But there it is. I mean, it also means we've got to consider some of the more ambitious, bordering on audacious proposals that could really change the game. Maybe like the conceptual equivalent of geoengineering in the climate change story. I don't know if that's a position that this commission wants to take, but I do hope you will debate it just as the IPCC must have debated similar kinds of issues when it began in 1988. It didn't always make the IPCC very popular, but they've been mostly right. So for me, I think there is a place in this conversation to, let's quote Herman Kahn, think the unthinkable. And I heard a couple ideas today that to me seem unthinkable, but also need to be addressed. So I'm just going to comment on two of them. One, this notion of thinking about models of public health. Look, in the public health arena, we persuade people, we incentivize people, but we also sometimes find ourselves coercing people to do things differently. Seatbelts, vaccines, and we're close to that on smoking. That's a very, very countercultural kind of view for the way we've come to think about internet society or internet culture. But somebody's got to address it. Second countercultural view. Remember back in the late 1990s, David Eisenberg from AT&T coined the phrase the stupid network to refer to the end-to-end principle of internet organization. And it's so deeply embedded in the way we think about the internet that it seems unquestionable. But I heard a lot today about this sort of notion that the stupid network means that the network is also polluted, almost like a cesspool. And I wonder if it's time to kind of put a question mark on that and ask ourselves, I think Gilman said, referred to the idea of everybody walking around with guns and vests. Maybe there's a level of absurdity there that needs to be reconsidered. So I think question marks need to be put over some of those long-term cultural issues, and somebody's got to do it in a way that actually captures the attention of people. So look, one thing I want to say about the short term, and then I'll stop. I think what has really stood out for me over the last year as I've invested most of my time in trying to understand this issue is the need from the university perspective and from the government perspective and from the industry perspective to work together on one very simple principle, which is shortening the transmission belt from the results of basic research into policy and action and markets. Now, I'm aware of the risks of shortening it too much. I don't want to get caught in a beta software trap. I don't want to get caught in a interim technologies trap. Look, we may not want to invest a generation's resources in the cybersecurity equivalent of hybrid cars if we know a fully electric car is just around the corner. But I think right now we're probably heavily weighted on the other side. Technologies are taking too long to find their way out of the lab and into the product. So there are analogies here and there are precedents here. A useful analogy might be the FDA. The FDA used to get beat up daily by the pharma sector and by patient groups for taking risk aversion with promising new drugs to an extreme. But the FDA has really changed in that regard over the last decade. And at least in some cases is now asking in a much more sort of, I'll call it risk prudent manner, with a more experimental and a less precautionary principle mindset. Now it's a little bit different. People are dying of untreatable diseases, but some of what I've heard today has led me to believe that in fact, that's the way some of these issues are gonna feel over the next couple of decades, or the next couple of years. So look, this doesn't all have to be about new technologies and scientific breakthroughs. Some of it could be about pretty simple, I think, business applications, business models, and essentially kind of common sense. Here is a really concrete example that anyone who has bought and sold a house in the state of California will immediately get. I'm talking about these pages and pages of disclosures that nobody reads, of course, in which you are required to tell the buyer about the repairs that you made in the plumbing system 30 years ago. In the next couple of years, how many IoT devices are you going to have in your home? 300, 400? shouldn't I have to disclose those to the buyer when I sell the house? Wouldn't the requirement for disclosure of the IoT in the home create a bunch of interesting incentives for IoT customers and then manufacturers to build their devices with a different mindset and business model around security? I know that means taking on the National Association of Realtors. And I know that's not the favored way for most technology people to spend their time. But I think the more we can focus on shortening that transmission belt from basic research to the devices, protocols, technologies, and network concerns that we know are coming, all the way down to the relatively mundane issues like the IoT devices in my house, the better we could do. And as that transmission belt shortens, you'll be creating the kinds of incentives that universities need and researchers on university campuses need to actually do things that serve the public interest in an immediate and focused way. So let me stop with that and turn it back to you folks for any comments or however you want to handle the rest of the time, Tom.
See, fine. If anybody has any questions, or we can... Appreciate it. We appreciate the center's hosting us today. It's been terrific. And you and your colleagues, thanks. Thanks for your comments today. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much for being here.
Thanks to you for the good work today. Much appreciated. Thanks. And the next item on the agenda is a public comment period. And so the first person on our list, and we have a microphone, is Russell Thomas. Is Russell here? Afternoon.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. I've submitted written comments, and this being the end of the day, I want to give a briefer, more colorful, and hopefully more memorable version. I have one recommendation. For an initiative for novel R&D processes to promote institutional innovation, and in my short 5 minutes, I'm going to explain everything that's packed in that sentence. So what do I mean by institution? I want to use a simple analogy of an orchestra or a band. The hardware, the software, the technology of the band is the instruments. What they play is policy. How they play it and the skills they develop it and the range of performance and who they play to, those are the institutions. Using that crude analogy, I contend, ladies and gentlemen, that we as a society, globally we, are really great at instruments. We are somewhat great and certainly prolific at musical scores. In practice, we're actually pretty poor and we stumble a lot when it comes to actually the development of an orchestra in practice over time. The comments of the previous panel, the comments of the previous speaker, and I'm sure at previous sessions of this commission, you've heard example after example of policy changes or innovations that can be viewed as either primarily or secondarily as institutional change or institutional innovation. I'm hard-pressed to pick one area that is purely technical or purely policy. In fact, much of what this commission is doing is either policy or institutional change. So we can view the work of the commission here as an act or a process of institutional innovation. So I'm going to take another analogy. For all of the technologists and computer scientists in the room, remember when you first started programming, you were a coder. Once upon a time, you tried to grow a big system or join a big team, and you ran into the problems of coding without a discipline. And that's where software engineering comes in. It's the plan, it's the method for that gives order to coding. So when I talk about institutional innovation as a process, I'm advocating a process that gives not only order, but productivity and fruitfulness to the innovation process that we haven't had so far. I want to give four brief examples to make this somewhat concrete, and then I'll wrap up just with a summary. Parents in the room might identify with this. I have a son who's just graduated high school. On the issue of incentives, my real goal with him is to cultivate intrinsic incentives. So I may have carrots and sticks operating on him from the outside, but I really want him to develop, he's self-managing. And I really strongly recommend that this commission adopt that distinction and focus on institutions that are based on intrinsic incentives as opposed to extrinsic tax cuts or liabilities. Here's a contrary example that shows how hard institutional innovation is. How many have heard of the trustee certificate, trustee.org? There was research that demonstrated that this was a contrary indicator of security and quality, meaning bad guys had a better, had more incentive to make this visible and good guys did not. So if you saw that, you were more likely to be visiting a malicious site. But the trustee organization was very well intentioned and very well considered. But it just shows the difficulty of coming up with good institutional designs. My last example is best practices. We're in the second or third year of the NIST Cybersecurity Framework, and that's supposed to be a framework which embraces best practices. Would anybody be surprised if there's no process for vetting and testing any practice in cybersecurity, therefore no credible basis for saying any practices are better than any others? So what does this say about this process, the institutions that are being built around it, the mandates, the how executives stand behind it and saying we're doing things to support that framework? So consensus and conventional wisdom are the enemies of institutional innovation. We shouldn't be starting with consensus. We should be pushing that toward the end of the process. So to close, I want to highlight a talk that was given here at Berkeley at a conference maybe 4 or 5 months ago. Duncan Watts is at Microsoft Research, famous for his research on social networks. And he called for problem-oriented computational social science. And by this he meant, let's pick Goldilocks problems. He gave the example of self-driving cars, where the solution is, you know it when you see it, but the getting there is important and interesting. And it may even involve dramatic new theory, new methods, new ways of organizing. And I would encourage the commission to look at all of the suggestions that have been given to you and try to identify potential Goldilocks problems that might be the focal point for novel, different, unique R&D processes. So the process of innovation can be a focus of R&D itself. We can learn from other fields. In my written comments, I gave 5 or 6 examples. And there's no need to wait on this. We don't even have to wait till the commission is done with its work. You can connect with people who are already doing this or inclined to do this. And wouldn't it be great if in the commission's report, we could point to 3 or 4 or 5 examples that are seedling projects that are already underway and say, we want to do more about more of this or extend it. So thank you for listening, and I appreciate your time.
Next is James Elstey. Afternoon.
Thank you. James Elstey. I work at the University of Nevada, Reno. We're just across the hill. I wanted to give you some examples of laws we have on the books in Nevada that satisfy some of the topics we've been talking about in incentivizing business. In 2009, and I want to impress upon you that these laws are written in a way that is future-proofed, with a little caveat that nothing's perfectly future-proof. The first law was written in 2009. It's referred to as Nevada's encryption law. It provides a safe harbor incentive to businesses that encrypt personally identifiable information. And the safe harbor, if they have a breach and are not negligent, provides them a safe harbor from any civil litigation. So you can have a breach. If you're encrypting that PI in transport, you will not be subject to civil litigation for that breach. That law provides a very distinct incentive for businesses to apply encryption. The problem with encryption is encryption has a shelf life. It changes. The way we future-proofed that law was by not embedding in the law actual language about encryption. We embedded a reference to standards bodies that set encryption standards. So things like FIPS 140. If you comply with that standards body's encryption standard, you are compliant with our law. The second change we made to the breach disclosure law, by the way, this is NRS 603A if anybody's interested in looking it up. We changed the definition of personal information. Definition of personal information was established with SB 1386 in California years ago, your name, social security number, et cetera, et cetera. We had a freshman assemblyman in Nevada who was very interested in including driver authorization cards in that definition, because driver authorization cards are issued to non-resident individuals. What we added to that law is something that does not exist in any law that I'm aware of, which is we added your user credentials and your password or other authentication mechanism to your personal identification definition. So instead of the vendor owning your user ID and password, you have an ownership interest in that information, and you have a right to have a breach disclosure if that information is compromised. We had a State Department delegation at the university a month or two ago from about five or six European countries. We were talking about the Data Protection Act, all the things that are going on over there. They were specifically intrigued by the laws we're writing in Nevada and what we were able to put on the books. Now, what I would tell you about Nevada, which most people don't know, is it's a really easy state to get laws written because we meet every 2 years in the legislature, and it's just a circus. So it's a small state. We have access to the legislature. We could go in and talk to the legislators about these laws and about how important cyber was. Extremely critical for the legislators to understand why they're writing these laws. So with Assemblyman Flores, he had a very genuine interest in protecting his constituents with that driver authorization card, and he needed some guidance about how to incorporate some language that wouldn't defeat the purpose of changing the definition, but would actually enhance it. I'll close with something that I'm hoping to do at the University of Nevada that speaks to the workforce development. We're building a cybersecurity program in Nevada, and one of the accessible analogies that we're working with is the public health analogy. So public health becomes very accessible for non-technical people to understand the cybersecurity problem. If we talk about antivirus, we can do that mental calculation that says, well, it's kind of like, you know, the antibacterial stuff for our hands. What I am hoping to build to solve part of the workforce problem is a teaching hospital, okay? A teaching hospital is how we train medical professionals. You bring those medical professionals through a program, they learn basic medicine, they learn basic techniques, and then they're allowed to go into a residency where they actually apply those techniques on real patients in the under the supervision of experienced professionals. Well, in a cyber teaching hospital model, we have in our academic institutions the mechanism for bringing those people up through the program and teaching them those basic skills. What we're missing is that practical application that they need before they become effective physicians, cyber physicians. To build a teaching hospital is a simple thing. It's incredibly simple relative to a medical facility because we can do virtual cyber interventions without having physical facilities. The patients for the cyber hospital are plentiful. We'll work with the state. We'll be able to provide support to the state and its environment. We'll be able to provide support to the industry in Nevada, to those companies that are in the state who have an interest in improving their cybersecurity. That's collaboration, and that's how I believe we can make a significant impact on the workforce problem. And as I said, I'm hoping to get this done in Nevada. However, if they don't want to do that, Betsy and Steve, I'm going to come across the hill and come talk to you guys about it, because I think it's a brilliant way to bring people into the profession and to get highly skilled cyber practitioners that we need in large amounts. And with that, I'll thank you for your time and the opportunity to speak to you.
We have one more.
Who may not be here.
Jacques Francoeur?
May have already left.
San Jose State?
But he submitted a comment.
Okay, great. Sam, if you have any.
Hey, Tom, I just want to say I'm from the great state of Nevada, and we love the laws up there, especially the tax law, too, so.
I have one comment on that. UAB has a very similar program to the one that you described, where they have students actually working on solving real cybersecurity problems. They do a lot of work specifically with banks, and I've had interns from UAB come out to California through that type of program. So you might want to talk to Professor Gary Warner there for his experiences. Yes.
Any other comments? So we have our next hearing in Houston on July 14th, and we'll focus on critical infrastructure and state and local efforts to deal with cybersecurity. We just heard a good discussion here today about some of the kinds of things that we should be looking at, inform ourselves about, as well as to talk more deeply about the relationship between the federal government, state and local governments on cybersecurity. Any other comments with that, Sam?
Yep, it's all yours.
So we'll close out the meeting. Thank you all very much.
Meeting is adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you all.